In the last episode of Inside the Crime, we learned more about the horror visited on Charles Self in the early hours of January 21st, 1982.
Charles Self was stabbed 14 times and six of those were through and through.
Did Charles Self have any defensive wounds?
Very few, very, very few.
We also heard about two potential suspects. One of them, a mystery man who got a taxi with Charles back to his home in Monkstown on the night of his murder. The other, mistakenly walked into an upstairs bedroom almost an hour and a half after Charles walked in his front door.
It was a very distinctive man with black curly hair and dark eyes, and quite a handsome sort of man, somebody around late 20s, early 30s. The drawing and the description of the person's voice doesn't match with the person that came home in the taxi.
In this episode of Inside the Crime, we're going to follow those initial leads. We'll also look at how the murder investigation developed after Charles' story moved off the front pages. Over time, as hundreds and hundreds of gay men were pulled in for questioning, many feared there was an ulterior motive at play. This was 1980s Ireland, a hostile time and place to be gay.
So unless society changes, the homosexual will always be the outsider, the man or woman out of step. Their attributes will be ignored, their sexuality condemned. So really it's not a matter for lawyers, for doctors, for clergymen alone, but for all humanity.
On a damp, dark and dreary Monday afternoon, 4 days after the murder, a large crowd shuffled into St. Andrew's Presbyterian Church in Blackrock. They gathered to remember Charles, all still in shock, all in complete disbelief. His friend Christine Falls was among them.
It was just packed to the rafters. I don't remember much of the service itself, but I remember it became a sort of, it was a focal point for those of us that wanted to remember him and to show a solidarity with especially his family as well.
Very telling, I suppose, and indicative of the type of man that he was, that it was so packed, as you say. From my reading of some of the newspaper articles from that time, the Director General from RTE attended, which just went to show how well respected he was in the workplace. I wonder, do you remember any family members coming over from the UK to attend that memorial service?
I don't, because I didn't know any of Charles's family. I knew that he was very, very close to his aunt because he'd speak about her a lot and frequently would fly back to see her and things. But no.
As it turns out, Charles's beloved aunt, the woman who raised him after his mother died when he was just a boy, was at that memorial service. She had flown over from Scotland with another aunt of his to collect his remains. Charles was born in Oswestry, a railway town in the west of England, but she brought him up in Glasgow, and he very much identified as a Scotsman, and a proud Scotsman at that. He had a very special bond with her. He used to introduce her as his mother, and he regularly made the short trip home to see her. In fact, he'd been over just weeks before his murder. Little did they know, it would be for the last time. Lots of his RTE colleagues attended the service too, including his friend and fellow set designer Alan Farquharson, who remembers a brief exchange with Charles's aunts.
Just a hello, really. And they were just mind-boggled. I have a recollection of one of them saying simply, who'd want to do that?
And did you or any of your colleagues or any of Charles's friends have any idea who would want to do something like that to Charles?
Absolutely not.
Some of those on the hunt for Charles's killer were also at the church that day. They too had no idea who would want to kill him. But by now, they had leads. They knew his final movements, and they were trying to track down two potential suspects. The mystery man in the taxi was their main focus. They were convinced this was a young male prostitute that Charles picked up on Burr Quay. But that theory didn't wash with those closest to Charles. He wasn't known to bring rent boys home. In fact, he was very careful about bringing anyone home, and with good reason. as his friend and former flatmate Bill Maher now explains.
I think he had brought somebody back before I knew him, and he got robbed. And he was certainly nervous about bringing somebody into the house that he didn't know, or who didn't know somebody who knew them, you know.
So he would have been...
He would have been cautious, I think, yeah.
And obviously because of the experience that he had the previous year or two, whatever it was.
Yeah. He didn't even like me bringing people back to the house that he didn't know, or if he hadn't been with us when I met somebody, you know.
So was this a robbery gone horribly wrong? As Bill mentioned there, Charles had been robbed before. Gay men were seen as easy targets by rollers who used to prey on them by pretending to be gay themselves. In 1980, a man called Eddie Cash set up the Lonely Gay Society. It started off as a way for gay men to meet other gay men, but soon became a place for people to report these so-called queer bashings, which were rampant. At the time, Fairview Park near Clontarf on Dublin's north side was one of the most dangerous places to go cruising. Eddie used to stand outside its gates, handing out leaflets, warning those who went there for sex about the rollers who lurked within, some of whom moved in packs. The caption on this leaflet said it all. It read, "You don't have to be gay to be attacked, robbed, beaten up or blackmailed, but if you are, it helps." Roller robberies went unreported for two reasons. Firstly, the victim was often too embarrassed to go to the guards. And secondly, even if they did, they had little confidence in their complaint actually being investigated. Eddie made several reports to Clontarf Garda Station, but as he pointed out to an RTÉ reporter back in the day, he felt they always fell on deaf ears.
I got browned off dealing with Clontarf. Anyone that has gone up to Clontarf in the past with complaints have just got a negative response, you know, and made people very, you know, distrustful of going up there.
Charles was an openly gay man about town who looked like he had money to burn. He'd also been drinking in the hours leading up to his murder. So did somebody see him as easy prey and easy money? That's what the guards first thought, but it didn't stack up. Charles loved gold jewellery, and on the night in question, he was wearing a gold chain, a gold watch, a gold signet ring, and an earring, none of which were taken. To solve this case, the detectives felt they had to find the mystery man in the taxi. They were convinced it had to be one of the two rent boys who were in the Hot Pot Cafe on Burr Quay at the same time Charles was there on the night of his murder. Again, this was one of the last times he was seen alive. Kitty, a 19-year-old boy from Bluebell in Dublin, was taken in for questioning. He denied being there, but the guards didn't believe him, and they asked the taxi man who took Charles's fare that night to take a look at him. They wanted to know if he was the mystery passenger who went home with Charles that night. He shook his head. It wasn't him. He'd never seen this man before. The other rent boy was also tracked down. Ruby, from Coolock in Dublin, had an alibi. While efforts to find the mystery man in the taxi continued, the detectives were also eager to find the man who woke Bertie Tyrer up at 2 a.m. Again, Bertie worked with Charles and he was the one who found his body that morning. He didn't live in the Mews, but was staying there due to the bad weather. He drew a sketch of this second mystery man. According to Bertie, this man had dark, curly hair, was well-spoken with a West Brit accent. Bertie was a designer. He drew every day of his life. So surely this sketch was of value. Or was it? I asked Bill. Was that sketch ever published?
Never.
Why?
I have no idea.
Have you ever asked the guards to publish it?
I did in the last few years, and they said they couldn't find it. They kept insisting to me that I never mentioned it in my initial statement. And I said, but I hadn't been shown it then. And I said, I can still visualise holding it in my left hand in the Garda station. And I told them, I know two other people can corroborate the existence of it. And when I told them that, I supplied them with their phone numbers and details. They came back to me and then said, oh, we found it. But it's in very bad condition. It didn't try to convince me that it never existed. And then they said it did exist, but it's in bad condition now. I mean, you can enhance the drawing. It's not, it was quite large. Can't have been that bad unless somebody trampled on it on the floor or whatever, and then how did they even know it was the drawing I was referring to?
We don't know why exactly they haven't published it, but would you like to see this sketch
published? I would.
Do you think it would be helpful?
I think it might too.
Not only did the investigation team refuse to publish Bertie's sketch, they also held back a photo fit of the mystery man in the taxi. Again, the person who went home with Charles that night. The driver was shown bits of photos of other people. Sets of eyes, ears, different face shapes, etc. And on the back of that, a reconstructed image was produced. He said the man was wearing a neat two-piece suit. He was about 25 years old, with fair, brushed back hair flopping over his collar. His longish face was clean shaven. He remembered the two passengers sitting close together in the back of the cab. There was some chit-chat, not much. Charles's companion seemed quite drunk. When he spoke, his speech was slurred. Charles had a few drinks on board too, but was still well able to hold a conversation. It struck us as odd that neither the sketch nor the photo fit were published in 1982. But whatever about then, surely now, 40 years on, they could still be useful, maybe jog someone's memory or appeal to a guilty conscience. So why not release them? We'll follow up on that. But for now, let's focus on other lines of inquiry.
A few weeks beforehand, Charles had people back to the house. On Christmas Eve night, he'd had about 10 or 12 people back. And I know they were keen to know who was in the house that night from a fingerprint elimination point of view.
I should say that by now, the Mews had been extensively dusted for prints. And unsurprisingly, given all the comings and goings there, the place was covered in them. After some painstaking investigative work, most of them were identified, accounted for, and crucially, excluded from Garda inquiries. However, one mark remained. It was the middle or ring finger of someone's right hand, and it was lifted from a drainpipe just outside the kitchen window. Remember that when the guards arrived at the scene, on that bitterly cold January morning, that window was open. A bloody shoe print was also found in the carpet. It was size 7 or 8. The sole had a series of parallel wavy lines with a raised ripple pattern. More on those later. But now, back to Bill.
I had gone down home to Tipperary to my parents, so I wasn't there, but I did know probably 6 people who were present that night. I didn't know who the others were or didn't know their names. So they were very much focused on identifying any people that might have been in the house the few weeks prior. And there was one person of interest that Charles had back to the house a few nights prior. And we couldn't get a taxi that night, so we actually walked out from town on the icy roads. There's no taxis, no buses, nothing. His car was broken down. And I didn't have my car with me. So we actually walked out and the guards asked me to go out to the bars and if I saw this person to call them. So I remember some people being surprised when I went into the Bailey the following night, you know. So I said, oh, Charles just been murdered. I wasn't going to explain to them that the guards had actually asked me to go out.
Little did they know you were actually trying to help your friend.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, one mutual friend said, oh, we all thought you did it. Because we were always together, you know.
Mm.
So I did spot the person in Rice's eventually. And I remember it was button A and button B at the time. And my hands were shaking when I went up to... It wasn't exactly a role I liked, you know, but to ring the guards to say that he was in the bar.
As soon as Bill's shaky hand pushed down the phone, the guards sprang into action. This man knew where Charles lived. He'd been there just a few nights before the murder, and now, thanks to Bill, he was in their sights. They swooped swiftly. But alas, he too had an alibi, and his story checked out. So by now, the detectives had wiped Ruby and Kitty's names off the evidence board back at base. Their theory of a robbery gone wrong didn't hold water, and they still hadn't a clue who the mystery man in the taxi was. nor had they figured out who the man in Bertie's sketch was. It was time to cast the net a bit wider. In 1982, most people had a contacts book. It's hard to imagine a world without mobile phones, but it would be another 3 years before the first cellular call was made in Ireland. Funnily enough, the man who answered that inaugural call was in Charles's book, and he was among those contacted by the investigation team.
I got a phone call sometime after the investigation had started, weeks, I would think. And the guards identified themselves and said, look, we are investigating the murder of Charles Self. Were you acquainted with him? And I said, yes, I was. And I said, why are you calling me? And they said, well, we were going through his contacts book and we're going through every name. And now we've come to the K's. Pat Kenny's there under K, or words to that effect. So we're calling you. And I said, that's fine. And they said, were you ever in the Mews in Monkstown? And I said, no, I never was. That's where his body was found, where he lived. And then they said, how well did you know him? And I explained, just as I've explained to you, that he was a designer on the show. And that would be the reason for my name being in his contact book. 1982, no mobile phones. So everyone had to contact each other by landline. And that's how it was, that we all had each other's telephone numbers for calling each other for business purposes. So they got to me and they said, look, we'd love to come around and talk to you sometime about your contacts with Charles Self. And they said, where do you live? And I said, the Mews, to the rear of number 82 Leinster Road, which is where I lived. And there was a silence when they heard Mews. And then they heard me say, I lived in a Mews, and this made some uncanny contact in the Gartha mind. So they said, we'll be round shortly. Will you be there? And I said, sure. And within, I'd say, an hour, they were knocking on my door. And they came in and they sat me down and I welcomed them, offered them tea, coffee, whatever. And they asked me the same questions that you've been asking about how well I knew. And I explained everything. And I couldn't really help them in any shape or form. And then they said, do you mind if we ask you a question? And I said, no, fire away. And they said, you wouldn't happen to be one of them boys yourself, would you? And I was shocked and aghast and also somewhat amused, because by that they meant, was I gay? And I said, no, I don't happen to be one of them boys myself. And then they started to talk, and there was a lot of homophobic stuff in their conversation about the nature of investigating the gay scene in Dublin and all the rest of it. And shortly after that, they left.
It's quite shocking to hear about Pat's interaction with the guards. Like, what difference did it make if someone was one of them boys, as they put it? Why even ask the question? And it reminded me of something Christine said about her own experience when she was interviewed.
I remember that there were two guards present. I remember one of them was very solicitous. And I remember one particular question, which was, why is a woman like you hanging out with people like that? And that phrase was used, with people like that.
With people like that. One of them boys. Truly shocking terms and lines of questioning being used and pursued by our police force. What's worse is their attitudes mirrored most privately and publicly held views. Remember, this was a time when gay men were considered criminals. The whole scene was underground. Gay sex had been outlawed since 1861. It was considered an abominable crime, and those found guilty could be sent to prison and forced to do hard physical labour for the rest of their lives. Attempting to, but not actually doing this so-called abominable crime, could cost you 10 years hard labour behind bars. And if that wasn't enough, in 1885, acts of gross indecency between men were made illegal. These grossly indecent acts were never defined in law. Instead, it was left for judges to decide on a case-by-case basis. The maximum penalty, 2 years in jail. When Charles was murdered in 1982, gay men still lived and loved under the long shadow of these cruel laws. So it's through this prism we must look back at his case.
Hello?
Hi, Tony. It's Aisling, the producer. How are you?
Aisling, how are you?
Good, good, good. I heard a little bit of background noise there. Are you still happy to take that call with us?
Oh, yeah, it's the fan.
Oh, you're grand.
Tony Walsh came out in 1979, 3 years before Charles's murder. He's the founder of the Irish Queer Archive and one of Ireland's most prominent gay activists. He lives in Turkey now, but agreed to join us on a call to give us an insight into what Dublin was like for a young gay man in the early 80s.
There were dangers everywhere. I mean, because gay men were criminals, branded as criminals and social outcasts, as a gay man, you risked getting a hiding if you looked gay, whatever that means. If you looked gay, or if somebody just sat upon you, you're an easy target. You could be kicked out of a bar and refused service in a hotel or a cafe because there was no anti-discrimination legislation. And all of that would only be put in place after decriminalisation in 1993. So, I mean, that's still, you know, that wasn't even a glimmer on the horizon in the early 80s. So there was extraordinary levels of exclusion, marginalisation and oppression. In the early 80s, Dublin felt like a very small city. The city was dirt poor, it was very derelict, it felt dangerous a lot of the time. And large sections of the city were just wastelands. There wasn't a commercial gay scene of the sort we visualise today. A lot of them, because intimacy, how gay men negotiated desire and intimacy was so fraught and was illegal, it meant that we sought out sexual contacts in the shadows a lot of the time. Then, you know, you couldn't go. When I came out in 1979, the first gay dance club I went to was Flickers in the Hirschfeld Centre in Dublin. And that was the first, well, that was the second attempt at a significant LGBT community resort. The options just were so limited. They really were. Considering that you could actually get 2 years in prison for kissing or holding hands in public, the way we went about looking for desire and intimacy was very secretive. It was very coded. And in many cases, gay men and gay and bisexual men either found each other in public toilets or in parks or in semi-public private spaces.
I've heard the social scene described by others as hidden in plain sight. And I think that's what you're kind of getting at, in the sense that you had bars like the Bailey or Bartley Dunn's where people could and felt to a certain degree comfortable with their sexuality in these places. And I know he was a good few years older than you, but I wonder, did you know Charles Self back in 1982?
I knew Charles because he came into the Hirschfeld Centre, and the Hirschfeld Centre was one of those sort of catch-all spaces because it offered something that wasn't available anywhere else. I'm thinking of the dance club Flickers now. So you got to actually know a lot of people, certainly on nodding terms. And I knew a couple of other people who were very chummy with Charles, including his former flatmate, Vincent Hanley, because Vincent was a Clonmel man like myself, and also from time to time actually guest DJed in Flickers in the Hirschfeld Centre. So yes, I would have been aware of Charles. I do remember just my reaction afterwards. I mean, feeling the revulsion and horror, especially when word leaked out about the manner of his killing. By the way, I should point out that getting news of a gay man being murdered in Dublin wasn't quite a rare event back in the early and mid-80s. It happened on a fairly regular basis. There were murders, a litany of murders from the 70s onwards, what we now regard as anti-gay hate crimes. And after a time, it became inured to them because, you know, we understood, certainly those of us who were more politically involved, or politically astute, we're aware from anecdotal evidence that the police just didn't take them that seriously.
In the weeks and months following Charles's murder, a worrying trend began to emerge within Dublin's gay community. Hundreds and hundreds of gay men were being pulled in for questioning by the investigation team. Some were outed at home, others in their workplaces. There were allegations of Garda harassment. Many felt they were being treated as suspects just because they were gay. Their fingerprints and photos were taken. At the time, Peter Murtagh was security correspondent with the Irish Times. He followed the story closely and kindly invited us to his home in Greystones, County Wicklow, to share his thoughts about what was going on.
Hi, Peter.
How's it going?
Good to see you.
Aisling, nice to meet you. How are you?
Thanks for having us. I come bearing gifts.
We're full of dogs, I'm sorry.
Oh, don't apologise for that.
It's okay.
Oh, look at
these
girls. That's Sky.
Sky.
And this is Mr. Biscuit.
Hello, Mr. Biscuit.
Come on in, guys.
Wow, you've a full house.
I do remember hearing about it. I remember working on it. He was murdered, and it was a particularly vicious murder. And yes, it produced great convulsions within the gay community, not just for the murder itself. That community would have felt incredibly vulnerable as a result of what happened and what had been happening and didn't get enough attention. But also they felt vulnerable for the way they perceived the guards to be investigating it. So when the Charles Self murder happened, and you start getting all these, as you say, a little while afterwards, reports about guards are interviewing hundreds upon hundreds upon hundreds of gay men and asking them questions about their lifestyle and all of this. It frightened the community, and you started getting demonstrations. Why are the guards acting like this? Why are the guards blanket interviewing gay men? So you had an already vulnerable community feeling even more vulnerable and under threat. And perhaps in this this broad sweep, this trawl through an entire community, the focusing on who really killed this man was perhaps not in focus, in fact, and was blurred because it was a huge wide search. And that prompted demonstrations.
Within a week of Charles Self's murder, there were reports that the guards had asked one of the gay organisations to hand over its membership list. That was strongly denied and never proven. But what's undeniable is that up to 1,500 gay men were interviewed by detectives claiming to be investigating the murder. Many complained of being asked more questions about their sex lives and what happened to Charles, which raised serious concerns of an ulterior motive. As the chatter within the gay community got louder, there was a real fear that the guards were more interested in compiling a gay dossier than finding his killer. I asked Peter if he was aware of this.
It was said to me, and as a reporter, I would have heard that from activists within the gay community who started questioning how the investigation was being handled by the guards. So the guards approached it in a way that I think was not focused on the actual crime. You know, I think that the generalised charge that this was a trawl through an entire community, for whatever reason, is well made. And I think the an analysis which would say that is not the best way to investigate a crime, I think is substantiated. You know, I mean, if there's a car crash, you don't start interviewing every car owner in the country. You actually look at the crash.
We're on the way to Ranelagh to meet Bill Foley, a lifelong gay activist. As he put it himself, he knew Charles by name and reputation.
Bill, how's it going? Frank.
Hello.
Nice to meet you. What a beautiful part of the city you're
in. Hi, sweet Jamie.
How are you?
Good.
Charles, as we all know by now, was a sociable animal. And if he wasn't out, he'd have friends over to the Mews for drinks. Bill may have crashed one or two of his parties.
He was a very generous and gregarious host, and I think he might have equally gate-crashed back to us, but somehow we never seemed to get to know each other very well.
Bill mightn't have known Charles very well on a personal level, but he remembers the whole gay community being shocked to its core when they learned of his death. He also vividly remembers the aftermath, and that's why we're here. We wanted to ask him about this so-called gay dossier.
I was involved in a relationship at the time. Myself and my partner were living here in this house together, and we were both activists. We were both founder members of the Dublin Lesbian Gay Collective. We had speculated ourselves that it was because we were part of a couple that we weren't asked to speak, and possibly because we were involved in kind of the protest movement. So I'm not sure why we weren't. It seemed to be random in some way. I mean, it was staggering, the idea that something like 1,500 men were interviewed for a murder crime, and the police would still say this wasn't a question of gay profiling. I don't know any other murder that would have that level of questioning of, you know, a number of people that potentially were involved in a crime. It seemed that there was no other reason for it except profiling. I mean, several friends I know would have been questioned. Now, some had kind of said that they'd prefer to have the questioning, you know, at home, for instance, rather than in a police station because it was more intimidatory. Others chose the reverse because for privacy reasons. But in general, we heard really horror stories about the approaches of the police, in the sense that sometimes they would turn up at a person's home, and particularly if the person was married, for instance, and was living a kind of secret gay life on top of their marriage, that would be a very intimidatory practice, you know, to arrive somewhere and say, we're looking to question you or your husband in relation to a gay murder. And equally turning up at people's workplaces, you know, again, very intimidatory kind of approaches. I worked on all of the organizations at different levels, and I was a founder member of the collective, which was meant to be looking at kind of social reform from a completely different way rather than law reform. We were trying to identify kind of radical socialism, left politics, kind of build alliances in that way. And so we felt that what was needed was actually a resistance to what we felt was overt police, you know, breaches in protocol. I mean, I think it's clear from the descriptions of some of the investigations that you hear individuals report back that nothing about the murder was asked of them. They were asked about their personal lives, their sexual lives, what sexual behaviors they engaged in. And on some occasions, they were physically jeered, you know, for their sexuality. So there's no way any of that could be attributed to proper police investigation processes or a murder investigation. So we were very clear that this was going on, and what we needed to do was to advise people of their rights, which is where the Gay Defence Committee came into play. And, you know, the idea of remaining silent, for instance, was something that was kind of anathema to the overall maybe advice that was around at the time, because you felt a vulnerability because you're engaged in illegal activity, ostensibly, through your sexuality, that you had to talk to the police. But we said, you know, you do have the right to remain silent. We put out an information card. We held a public meeting, kind of giving people advice around this, and said, you don't have to talk if you don't want to. And if you need to or want to, you have the right to be represented at the guard station in terms of questioning. And we did that because of the stories we were hearing about the nature of the questioning. And that questioning, I think, was so forceful as to warrant the response that we made.
So already fractured relations between the guards and the gay community were reaching breaking point, and things were about to get much worse. In the next episode of Inside the Crime, we look at how everything changed when two more gay men were murdered.
That became known as Ireland's Stonewall. A lot of gay men, they were so angry, and this feeling, this is happening too often. There's something systemic here. It's not just accident, or it's not just one person.
It seemed the guards had taken their eye off Charles's investigation, but many loose ends remained.
I'm aware that it was a weapon of opportunity, in that he didn't bring it to the scene with him. Now, the lady across in the courtyard, she heard a commotion. She heard this thing being pulled over, put against the wall. That's what woke Mary.
And was she considered a reliable witness?
Oh, she was, yeah. Oh, she was, sir.
And just when it looked like all leads had run cold, a potential suspect stepped out. of the shadows.
Similarity to the drawing that I'd seen. I'd never met him or knew of him or anything about him. I asked some friends of mine, did they know of him? They said, yeah, he used to drink in the Bailey and Bartley Duns.
Subscribe to Inside the Crime on the News Talk app, powered by Go Loud or wherever you get your podcasts. And for more exclusive content, visit newstalk.com/deeperinsidethecrime. We are really confident that someone out there knows something or saw something that could help advance Charles's murder investigation. If you are that person, please contact the Garda Confidential line on 1800 666 111. You can also email us at insidethecrime@newstalk.com. It's never too late. Inside the Crime was hosted by me, Frank Graney, produced by Aisling Moore, with sound mixing by Lachlan Hart. Archive clips in this episode were from RTE.